sounds as recorded on August 2nd, 1962 of Soho Street, Mina Mesner Flats.
Greetings, my child.
Greetings to you. Lucena?
Provided for lived away, and also to be well guarded from the roads in some places were dangerous, and it was essential and necessary to take with one many things which were of some value. Whole journeys, particularly of people of wealth, were fraught with dangers. It was necessary to be well armed, well protected. And he would oft-times travel from Rome to varying places such as Ostia or Pompeii or even further afield with what you would term in modern parlance a litter, and strung between two horses.
Yes.
Your brother and other members of the family and friends ride, some in front, some behind, and invariably your brother would ride at your side. Sometimes the women servants would ride on mules or ponies, but invariably when you travelled for comfort, this much apparelled and cushioned litter was yours, so that you should not be unduly fatigued and tired. In that time of which I speak, you were much devoted to your brother, so much so that it was common gossip and knowledge among your women friends, particularly, that you were not given to marriage, for all your attention and thoughts were directed upon this one brother.
There's Frederick, wasn't it?
In that age in which I speak, that incarnation of his, he was a fine figure of a man, but totally unlike what you would remember him in his last incarnation as Chopin. He was a man full of vigor and vitality. He was then, particularly at the moment I speak, in his 19th year. He was about to enter the service of the Emperor, and already had distinguished himself in the games in Rome, and on the occasion of which I am thinking particularly, when we were travelling, your family and ours, to Pompeii, he was to attend the games and to appear in some of the items on the programme. In those days, particularly, the younger sons of the house were often dedicated to the church, as you would say today, but in our day were dedicated to the temples and to the rituals of the church, not as in the time of the ancient Egyptians, but in a different sense. Quite often they would take to themselves a certain god as their particular chosen one, and they would enter into great ceremonies representing the house of which they were a member. And your mother, on this occasion, had recently been initiated into certain rites and ceremonies that his heart was not in these things. Although he had, to some extent, his insight, he was not drawn and was not affected by the grief which were common in that day and age, was not affected by the idea of the gods. But all that he did because it was expected of him, and I suppose you would now say it was done in a sense of automatism. His mind was a clear and fine one, and he had much desire to know truth, but because of his close initiation into certain rites and ceremonies of the gods, he saw behind the mask of the priests much that was dishonest and much that was unlike the things that he had aspired to and desired in the spirit. But he did not, of course, in any way show his opinions or his dissatisfactions, because for various reasons he had no desire to hurt his soul, and at the same time no desire to cause any dissension in his family or among his friends. And he accepted these things, but only on the surface. You and he, because you were so close, would oftentimes discuss these things. And though you yourself, in this particular time, had no practical experience of these things, you had what you then termed, perhaps, your woman's intuition, and you sensed that there was much that was yet to be discovered, much that there was yet to be found in regard to the things appertaining to the spiritual life. Neither you nor he were overdrawn towards the material pleasures then prevalent, and very seldom indeed, unless it was absolutely necessary or essential, did you attend many of the functions which were given. Only when you could would you try to avoid them. It was always difficult, because being so close to the court, oftentimes you were forced to attend these affairs, which often disgusted you and your mother, and caused both of you to feel that your age and time was degenerate. And many times when you entered into these things, you did so only because it was expected, and you therefore had to obey and to fulfill these things which were common among the peoples in high places. And you would like to escape to Ostia, or as I was saying, in particular on this occasion, to Pompeii. Although you knew of the many vices prevalent in Pompeii, there was much there that you enjoyed for the spiritual interest. You would meet interesting people from other countries, who had new ideas, new philosophies, new teachings to give. And you would meet, and you would discuss much on these matters. The Vetis, of whom I've spoken,
yes,
were very similar in likes to yourself and your brother, although they had been left a considerable fortune. civilization and own great estates. They were not over interested in material things, though they kept a house which would give the impression that they were materialists. And they did much that was expected of them, much the same as your family, and much the same as my own. We did so much on the surface because it was an age where you could not afford to offend. You could not afford to be different to your neighbours. You could not afford to bring about displeasure or disfavour. Much that you did was done automatically, as I've said, and the Bettys were similar in this respect. They had all the outward apparel and outward show indeed. If there was a fault in the Bettys, particularly the younger, when I say the younger, I refer to the twin that was born only a short time after the other.
Who was the twin?
And they would take great interest in wearing apparel. They were fond, over-fond, perhaps, of clothes and jewels, but it was because their natures were such that they were drawn to all forms of colour and beauty. And indeed, one might say, this was also because of a fault of yours at this time. But I do not see it now as such, because it was the love of beauty, the love of colour, the love of the artistic that was so strong that sometimes, perhaps, to those who didn't know, you gave the impression of being worldly on the surface, as I've said, when underneath both you and your brother and the Bettys, and indeed many of our compatriots and friends, gave this impression, which was not altogether so, because our interests were deep. We liked conversation, what you would call today intelligent conversation, conversation on matters and subjects which were very rarely discussed, because you must remember the majority of the banquets, the majority of the gatherings of people of quality in those days, the attitude of mind was purely for pleasure, material pleasure. Very seldom was conversation intellectual or intelligent. Indeed, so much wine was drunk in so short a time that very few knew what the other was saying or what they had said or what they were saying themselves. So it didn't really amount to anything, even if they had said the intelligent, it wouldn't have been heard or recognized as such. The idea generally was to enjoy yourself and to hell with tomorrow. In Rome particularly, this attitude of mine was very strong. Most peoples, particularly those in high places, were concerned with pleasure and lived for pleasure. Pompey had this reputation too, but Pompey was a strange city, so unlike Rome, so unlike any of the other great cities. Pompey was a place which was a hive of activity. It was a place where all manners and kinds of men and women came, some staying for a short time, others staying the whole of their lives. Many refugees, as you would call them possibly now, came from across the waters, escaping perhaps some persecution or escaping from some misdemeanor that they may have caused or created, and because of the fear that they lived in, were glad to escape. And Pompeii seemed to open up its gates to all humanity. It was possibly the most cosmopolitan city in the world, much more so than Rome. For Rome was typically Roman, though there were other nationalities there. Most of them were slaves. Most of them were people held in subjection, people who'd been brought from conquered countries and been brought in the capacity of servants and would not be allowed to talk, even if they could, on intellectual and intelligent levels, even if they were wanted to, they wouldn't be able. In other words, Pompey was far enough removed from Rome to be almost, you might say, a separate city, almost in a sense a separate country, if one could so say. It was a strange mixed place of many creeds and many religions and many doctrines and many gods and many peoples of all colours. It was always an interesting city, and one did not necessarily have to enter into the murkier, unhappy state of its being. It was a place where people mostly took their leisure, because it was a place where many escaped to, as I've said, from the heat and the turmoil of Rome in the hot summer months. And it was in this place that men particularly would gather in the baths for hours on end and would discuss great things, things appertaining to man and his birth and his death and his life, and all the things that are intriguing to the imagination. Plays were performed there by quite eminent men who had given up their whole lives to this, and also great writers would gather and write new works which would never be performed in Rome, because they would not have been appreciated. Rome was a city where gladiatorial displays and great scenic displays, when the arenas would be flooded with waters and boats would sail and mock battles would take place. Rome was an entirely different place of ceremony. Rome was a place of great display and great organization. It was too organized and too much opulent and too much concerned with display. Pompey had a knack, if you say, upon pounds, of being able to put on something which was different and unusual. Greek scholars, for instance, would come and they would perform and they would give plays, and also priests of other religions would stand quite freely and openly in the marketplaces and give forth their voice and their opinion, which would never have been allowed in Rome. There was much more license in Pompeii. It was an extraordinary city, a most complex city of great beauty and great corruption, of great minds, and minds that were very low indeed. It was the most extraordinary melting pot of the ancient world. Pompeii has never been truly explained to you in the world. Pompeii has never been truly understood. You see, Pompeii has always been considered a city of pleasure, and they have, the historians of peoples of recent years, formed this impression that Pompeii was just a place of licentious pleasures, which is not altogether true. That these things happened, of course, is common knowledge. But even so, it was by no means as licentious as Rome. But it was in a different way, in a different form. Much more license was given, much more freedom was given. And no one bothered Pompeii. It was sufficiently removed from the capital. And very rarely were they interfered with by those in high places. It was the most extraordinary city, as I would try to explain. And the houses in themselves were, many of them from their day and age, jewels. Although in Rome there were many great houses and many great mansions of greater dimensions, yet those in Pompeii were more interesting, more exciting, and more beautiful, and more artistic, because as I said, being a melting pot, being a place where all kinds of men or peoples came, they could draw upon artisans and architects and artists from all nations, and you had wonderful works depicted, wonderful buildings constructed, which were absolute jewels and gems, and much more refined in themselves were the buildings, and much more intimate. They were spacious, they were more intimate. There would always be the large atrium and the entrance, but there would be many small rooms, many small rooms where one could have, as it were, privacy, which one seldom had in Roman houses. And in the house of the Vetis, there was always this one room that was set aside when the lamps were lit, and we would sit on cushions and sit on couches. We were completely relaxed, and in the dim light, we would have what you call today seances, when Pharos particularly would come, and he would demonstrate, as you would say, the power of his mediumship or his psychic ability, and we would have contact and communion with those who had gone before. And many were they who came to us, many were they who spoke to us, and many were they who inspired us. And we formed in this house of the Vetis this, what you today would call a seance. And there we would go, whenever possible, to have these communications. But because even though Pompeii was a much more free city, we still had to be very careful. It was still considered forbidden, it was still considered even indeed to hold communication with the dead. But we were so interested and so intrigued and so fascinated and so convinced by this truth that we avoided where we could trouble, but we took great risks. The Vetti brothers themselves were an extraordinary couple. They were twins. I don't think this has ever been discovered, it has ever been discussed. As far as I know, it has never been realized that they were twins. One was born half an hour before what you call midnight, and the other was born after the midnight hour. And yet, though there is this difference, they were so similar in so many ways. They were so alike that often they would be mistaken, and people would not know which was which. But there was one peculiar thing which was always a guide to those who did not, and those who did know, and that was that one had on the left-hand side of his face a small scar, which during his birth was caused.
Which one was that, yourself? Could you tell me?
But you realize that both were the same name.
Same name?
About them both in the same name.
I don't know. thought I heard of him say the same name. Patrick Rosen.
Say what?
Don't disturb yourself too much if you can't manage more.
Vince, yes.
Yes?
Vince, yes.
Yes. Is that another name?
No, no, at Claudia.
Yes.
And he was Vince's.
I see. This is very, very interesting, Lucellus.
One thing I remember so well, when you were but a small child, your father returning from one of the campaigns, bringing back for you an elephant.
An elephant?
A small baby elephant.
Oh, dear.
And this is your link with elephants and the beginning of your love for them.
Is that, oh, thank you for telling me that, Lucellus, your mother.
Your father and I, as I told you previously, fought many campaigns with the Roman armies. When on one occasion we had fought in the east, we had many ships, and we brought back many animals. Some, I regret to say now, were used in the arenas. But this elephant that had been brought was your father's gift to your children.
Yes.
And you particularly were so enamored of this elephant.
Yes.
And you oftentimes, because the elephant, being a small one and grown up in his infancy and captivity, had become most tame. This was your pet. And indeed, often you would cause great consternation and cause great excitement when occasionally you would be taken out on this elephant, because elephants were very rare at that time. It's true that at a later time they become less, they became more common, but though there were a number of elephants we brought back from various campaigns, it was very unusual for such a small baby elephant to be grown, brought up in captivity, and it was your father's gift.
Yes.
And also an amulet or a necklace that was given to you, which was made by the natives, by the peoples in Egypt, came into your possession. It had been at one time in one of the tombs which had been rifled and broken into by robbers.
Yes.
And your father, as a gift, brought back this necklace, which you wore constantly, but at that time you did not know that that necklace from the tomb from which it had been taken was your own necklace returned to you. In an Egyptian incarnation, some century or two before, your head been buried, as was the custom, the various items, various things that you had liked, that had been part of your self, as it were. This necklace was in your coffin, which had been rifled, which had been, among other things, sold. And your father,
that knowing this goes back to you, your own necklace. That necklace has come to you three times in different incarnations. It came to you again when you had another incarnation also in Italy. But during the time of the Borgias and the Renaissance, this necklace has indeed so many things were lost in time, is buried in the earth, was dug up accidentally during the rebuilding and making of Igala in this incarnation of which I speak, in the time of the Borgias. And this necklace came into your possession again for the third time.
Oh, that's interesting. But how was that possible?
How do you mean, how was it possible?
For the necklace to come back to me three times, was there any special significance in that, or was it just
One may say there was no significance, or one may say there was great significance. The extraordinary thing is that each incarnation, the three incarnations, in the first instance, was your own property that had been presented to you by your lover. In the second, it was given to you by your father. In the third, it was dug up from the ground where it had been lost in time with many other things, and it was restored to you in the rebuilding of a villa in Florence.
Oh, my dear. Who was I then at that time, yourself?
You were one again of a house of repute and position, but deadly enemies of the Borgia family. And in consequence, you suffered at their hands, not you so much yourself, but members of your family. You were a Colonna.
Colonna?
Colonna.
I see.
But more of this some other time. What I'm trying to do, as far as is in my power, is to recapture for you incidents and things appertaining to incarnations that you have had with various people that have been involved with you, and how the pattern of your life and theirs has been interwoven and intermingled through the centuries, and how you have been able to assist each other and many souls because of your links and because of your deep-rooted devotion to each other and your great interest in the things of the Spirit, that you might be of some enlightenment and some help to others, not only those near and dear to you, but those even that have perhaps little claim on your time. Though you may not understand yet, you have been a great help to many in all these varying incarnations, and in some instances particularly, great help to some in particular, whose names we shall tell you of, I will tell you of, gradually. But I must ask you to be patient with me, because I am yet finding difficulties. What I find so difficult is to converse, to speak, to recapture and hold on to these memories and these experiences, to relate them to you with accuracy. I do not want to give you anything that is inaccurate. I only wish to give you that which I know to be correct and accurate. And I want, if I can, to give you a larger picture, a more clear picture of all these experiences and lives, so that you will then see more clearly than you do how you have been bound, not only with Frederick Chopin, but with others who have been near and dear and still are to you, some whose minds you are still interwoven with on earth and many of course who are here, who perhaps even themselves may yet speak to you. This I very much desire, for it would be better so in some instances that they themselves speak rather than I, possibly from their own particular incarnations where you have been closely linked, they can tell you more than I. But I am only the spokesman. I am only, as it were, the voice, the mouthpiece for others. And many things that I tell you may come, perhaps at times, haltering me, and rather laboured. But it is because I am acting on the behalf of these servants, who are desirous of you knowing more of them and more of your ties and links with them. I only ask, as I said to you on the previous occasion, that you be patient with me, and above all, to retain that open mind which is so essential if truth is to be allowed to enter in. Well, some things will be difficult to understand, and perhaps even appreciate. Much you will immediately understand, this I am quite sure of, for there will be some things that are difficult. But time perhaps will prove to you the truth and accuracy of these statements, especially in the coming months, which we are hoping will bring forth great things, inasmuch that we have in our mind and heart, desirous as we are to do and explain and express ourselves more fully and more clearly, and not only with words, but this I must say no more about now, because things that may strike you as strange shall happen to you, not necessarily only when you sit, but at other times too. But I only ask that you should go through these experiences with your mind clear and ready to receive. Things that you cannot understand, do not discard, but put them in abeyance until the proof is given you, as it will.
Yes.
I must go, child, but I will tell you more when next you sit. I will come again.
Okay.
And I will tell you of other things that I want so desperately to tell you. But please forgive me if I have to tell you these things often in this halting fashion, for in my desiring to bring to you clarity in these things, there must be at times this halting, this difficulty, that I should overcome, no doubt, these things that cause trouble and difficulty for me. May peace be with you.
Oh, thank you, you said.